This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the owner of a Wisconsin cricket farm is helping push for more human consumption of insects. We'll find out how creepy crawlies can actually be tasty treats. Now, the rail company Amtrak and the Federal Railroad Administration are looking at extending the Hiawatha passenger rail line that currently runs between Milwaukee and Chicago. Officials have expressed interest in building an Amtrak station in Madison to connect the route to the Twin Cities. It could also bring the route through Eau Claire. They're also exploring new connections from Milwaukee to Green Bay and the Fox Cities. The proposed expansions could create more convenient rail travel between some of Wisconsin's largest communities using funding from the Biden administration's bipartisan infrastructure bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see passenger rail service expanded here in Wisconsin? Do you want to see it come to your town if it's not there already? Would you use trains more or start using trains if there were more convenient routes here in the state? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Terry Brown is the Vice President for Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Rail Passengers. Terry, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me on again.
Before we get to the new proposals, remind us, for people who don't pay attention to rail travel, what options do we currently have in Wisconsin?
Well, car is obviously huge. The personal automobile is still the largest. The number of bus companies has been declining within the state of Wisconsin through the pandemic, but there are still some locally owned bus carriers that offer people options. Obviously, airplanes are still going. Dane County Airport, Mitchell Airport in Milwaukee, and how many others there? Maybe they're flying fewer flights than they did in 2019, but airplanes are still going. And railroads, my favorite topic to talk about. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the Hiawatha goes just between Milwaukee and Chicago, and we're looking to try to expand that as best we can. The Empire Builder continues west beyond Milwaukee, goes through Columbus and Toma and Wisconsin Dells, and La Crosse is the largest stop within the state of Wisconsin for the Empire Builder, and it continues up to St. Paul, Minneapolis, Twin Cities.
A lot of cities not on that list, including the second and third biggest, Madison and Green Bay, and the Fox Cities area, of course. Now, we have this map from Amtrak showing, hey, here are possible new routes that would add in those cities I just listed if all of them were done. Can you tell us a little bit about this Amtrak, I guess, vision for expansion here in Wisconsin?
Good word, vision. Okay, that's several entities. The Federal Railroad Administration has that. MIPR, the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail Commission, also has Madison and Green Bay on their wish list, their vision list to increase passenger rail routes within the state of Wisconsin. Those two that you outlined are not, how do I want to say this? Not coincidentally, those are the largest areas, as you said, that do not have passenger rail service now. And those seem to be a drop in the bucket. Those seem to be a gimme if you're a golfer. They seem to be a free throw to get service going, and they would most certainly be successful.
Let's look at Madison for starters, because it seems like this is the furthest along. Madison community leaders are not looking at if, but also where they would put a rail station. What kind of plans could be in the works, again, with this federal infrastructure funding for stops in Madison?
Madison should be eligible to get money to help them construct the rail station. They should be eligible to get money to help the engineering. HNTB was hired on to select a location for the station. That was a large part of that meeting last week Wednesday. By chance, did you go to that meeting?
I did not.
I did not either. So I participated on the Zoom call, the Zoom meeting, and everyone was very excited about how many people showed up in person, and even more excited about how many people showed up in the online version of the meeting. So there's this meeting helped educate the public on the fact that Amtrak and the FRA are going to have rules and expectations as to where the station goes, what they need to have. Madison also should have expectations of what the station would do for Madison. Most importantly, would be connecting to other modes of transportation. A lot of folks like to talk about the train gets you to Madison, but what about the last mile, is what it's called? What about the last mile? Will taxi cabs have access? Will the Madison bus have access to this train station? Those are all very important ideas that need to be discussed. And one of the things I like to discuss is something that another passenger rail company called Brightline in Florida has done very well at showing us how it can be done, is a 21st century train station with all the amenities surrounding the train station, be it retail, be it standard customer service, be it apartments or condos. And hopefully Madison does it right and gets all those ingredients in the mix.
Talking to Terry Brown with the Wisconsin Association of Rail Passengers, looking at visions from Amtrak and federal rail authorities for expanding rail service to Wisconsin or in Wisconsin. Madison, Eau Claire stops possible, Green Bay, Fox Cities. Do you want to see those? 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Let's go to your calls now. Lonnie is with us on the road from along one of those routes from Green Bay to Chicago. Lonnie, hi.
Hi there. I'm currently living north of Green Bay after moving back 4 years ago after being gone for 50 years. I was taking the Greyhound bus. They cut their services and it's now 10 hours to go. I would most definitely get on an Amtrak regularly, once or twice a month.
Lonnie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Terry, what it seems like this is maybe further in the visioning stage, that idea of connections through Milwaukee to the Fox Cities and Green Bay.
Well, different people and different, I don't want to say different processes, but different people are involved in getting a train through the Fox Valley to Green Bay. And in reality, well, some people would say, yeah, yes, the Green Bay Extension train is much farther behind the progress on the Madison Extension train. I would kind of disagree. The mayor of Green Bay, and his name eludes me at the moment, is quite the Amtrak advocate. And there's been quite a bit of stirring going on between Green Bay, Appleton. They're doing their own work. They're doing their homework behind the scenes just as well. So I'm not sure in the overall scheme, I'm not sure how far they really are behind Madison. It wouldn't surprise me if you want to call it a race, it wouldn't surprise me if Green Bay got there first, but remains to be seen. Keep in mind, one of the reasons why Green Bay has an outside chance of getting the train finished before Madison is there's already a mature freight rail line running most of the way. It's Canadian National Freight Lines. And although the mileage distance would be longer, look at the condition of the track between Watertown and Madison. There's going to be a lot of work that'll need to be done there. I'm not saying those are perfect reasons for Green Bay to get a train first, but I'm just saying, it's not out of the question. I for one wouldn't be surprised, but Madison, obviously, with the meeting they had last week, created a lot of attention, a bunch of excitement. Madison created a large amount of hope for passenger rail in Wisconsin, and not just passenger rail to Madison, but hope for passenger rail throughout the entire state of Wisconsin, where it makes sense. If we can get Madison to do it right this time compared to 2010 and all the fumbling that went on behind the scenes, not only in Madison, but in state government and in the federal government. If we can do it right this time and get it done, boy, that's going to create a large amount of hope for passenger rail in other parts of the state. If Green Bay hasn't done it already, it will certainly give them a boost to get it done. And you mentioned Eau Claire. They've been on the wish list for a decade.
Thanks for that call, Lonnie. We're talking to Terry Brown from the Wisconsin Association of Rail Passengers about potential Amtrak expansions in the state, a stop in Madison, maybe, proposals for Eau Claire, Green Bay, Fox Cities. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard there from James, who says, I'd love to see a line connecting Milwaukee with Green Bay and the Fox Cities. I'd use it to see friends and family in the Milwaukee area more often. And Julie writes, yes, wanted it 12 years ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Terry Brown, Vice President for Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Rail Passengers, with us to talk about possible expansion of rail service in Wisconsin. The ideas are there from Amtrak. The money may be there from the federal infrastructure bill. Is your desire there to have that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Marshfield. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Just wanted to share, I guess, travel experiences I've been having the past few years in Wisconsin. Actually a pilot myself, but we take our plane down to Milwaukee for maintenance, and it's been a nightmare trying to get from Milwaukee back home and back down. There really is no viable public transportation option. We're typically left having to do one-way rental cars, which are sometimes not available, often reluctant from the rental companies. So would love to see passenger rail expanded, and this is a great start for the state and keep us moving in the right direction.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. Would we get stops anywhere near Marshfield at any of these plans, Terry?
No. Listening to that story, boy, I am a little stunned. But no, your honest answer is no. He would still need to pick up some kind of connection from, say, Oshkosh, or Portage, or Tomah. That's a little bit of a disappointing story.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Good luck to you on that. Dave is with us now in Middleton. Dave, hi.
Hey, Rob and Terry. I really appreciate you guys putting this on the air today. Just wanted to share a quick story that I've had recently. I took my first trip to Europe this fall and took trains everywhere. Wherever I wanted to go, I could get on a train and make it happen. And when I got back home here, it just made me realize almost kind of how far behind we are with this public transportation on rail. I'm a resident near Madison, and I think we would use this to go to Chicago, go to Milwaukee, go to Eau Claire where my son goes to school. It would just be a perfect and much needed opportunity for our community here.
Dave, thanks
just
a lot.
Just wanted to make the comment.
Sure. Thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Now, Terry, one argument I think sometimes against widespread passenger rail in the United States is we're not Europe. The argument goes there's a lot of closer together population centers. Maybe we got that in the northeastern U.S. We're too sprawling for rail to make sense here. What do you say to that argument?
When you talk about the long distance connections, say you wanted to go from Chattanooga to Milwaukee, yeah, boy, that's a stretch. But go back to your comment about Europe is closer together. So think of that as a more regional network. And that's what Amtrak is trying to create centrally out of a Chicago hub here. So if you travel within the Midwest, say, let's say Madison to St. Louis, right now, boy, that's an expensive local connecting regional air flight, or it's a semi-grinding car drive down I-39 maybe to 55 if we took advantage of the regional opportunities that the Amtrak Connect Us map is giving us, that all of a sudden that Madison to St. Louis trip, that's not bad. It's still a day. It would still be, you know, a day's train ride. But I like riding on a train better than I do driving a car. I'm just saying.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Terry Brown with Wisconsin Association of Rail Passengers, looking at ideas, proposals. There are maps out there of possible expansions of passenger rail in Wisconsin with stops potentially including Madison and Eau Claire. They don't have them now. Fox Cities, Green Bay. No trains there right now. No passenger trains. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your concerns, your questions. 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jordan is with us in Marengo. Jordan, hi.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment that's specific and one that's more meta, so I'll go as quick as I can. Specifically to Madison, all four of the radiating lines out of Madison are all conjoined as one track under the Frank Lloyd Wright Center. I don't think there's enough room for a second track and a platform, but that's no problem logistically because you just put the staging yard just east of there along the power plant. There's quite a wide right of way that a couple, three tracks could be thrown in there. That's back under the Frank Lloyd Wright building, load up and split, and you could go in any of four directions out of Madison, which leads me to my more meta point, is the success of any rail endeavor is going to be getting butts in the chairs. And I feel like the most efficient way to do that is to develop commuter rail simultaneously or ahead of distance projects. Way you're installing a rail-centric mindset into commuters, getting them out of their cars. You know how horrible the Beltline is in the morning and the afternoon.
Jordan, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Terry, Jordan's really looking closely at the Madison options there. His first point, he's talking about, I think, a central location versus an outskirts sort of location for a train station. Green Bay would be making similar decisions. What are the pros and cons of going right downtown versus outskirts?
I'm going to backtrack on you one there.
Sure.
You take phone calls from people from Illinois? Really? Anyways.
We do.
Anyways.
We welcome our Illinois listeners.
the idea of the centrally located train station in Madison in particular, we'll keep it on Madison here, going through the isthmus has a lot of baggage with it. And that baggage is a slow running train. So HNTB is the company that the city of Madison hired to do a lot of the research on where would the best location be. And I agree, Monona Terrace would be wonderful, just off the lake. That would be a picture-perfect location for a tourist to get off a train and look across the lake and wow. That would be a wonderful picture. I'm just not sold on what it's going to take to get a train to Monona Terrace and then back out of the isthmus, whether the train is going to Milwaukee or going north to Portage, which means it's going either to, there's been talk about Eau Claire, La Crosse on its way to the Twin Cities. So that's my personal opinion on that. There was something else came to mind. Let's go back to getting passengers in the train.
Right.
I think this is just my sense. Talking to people in Madison, and certainly the reception that was had last Wednesday, something in the back of my mind is telling me that's probably going to happen much easier than we all think. I'll be honest, I keep comparing Madison, Wisconsin to Richmond, Virginia. They're very similar sized communities. They both have D1 universities. Richmond has a couple, I understand. And Virginia puts a train in, And it's like they do zero marketing and the trains are full. Several of their trains have not only returned to 2019 ridership numbers, they've exceeded them. That's crazy. I mean, the way we're used to thinking, and I understand I'm taking an Eastern Seaboard state and comparing it to Wisconsin, but I don't think the comparison is that far off base.
Thanks again for that call. To clarify, that was Marengo, Wisconsin, in Ashland County by Ashland. Terry, just in our last few moments, what are you watching for next? There are a lot of balls in the air here. I couldn't think of a good train metaphor.
The next thing coming from the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA, is this corridor ID program. That is the next big thing. Obviously, Madison needs to keep working with HNTB on selecting a station. But the corridor ID program, if Madison were to be given a corridor ID, if Green Bay and the Fox Valley train were given a corridor ID, that means the FRA has elevated your request status to a higher level and, quite frankly, increase the chances that you'll begin to be awarded some money. The corridor ID status will allow you to apply for money to help Madison pay additional money to HNTB, will help Green Bay and Appleton apply for money to help them. Both of them are going to need to do the exact same thing as Madison as far as locating a new train station.
Terry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me on again.
That's Terry Brown, Vice President for Public Relations for the Wisconsin Association of Rail Passengers, with us today to talk about potential plans for expansion of passenger rail here in the state. Tomorrow in the morning show, a look at the effort to create vaccines for Lyme disease. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Today is a great day in the history of me having a place to work. On this day in 1901, pioneering radio scientist and inventor Guglielmo Marconi proved the effectiveness of radio transmission and shut down his haters by sending a radio signal all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. As reported at history.com, by 1901, Marconi was already getting a lot of attention for his wireless telegraph devices, broadcasting locally, even sending signals across the English Channel. Could it work at a long distance? Doubters said no, because the curvature of the Earth would block the signal. Marconi said yeah, because the signal would bend around the Earth's shape. Turns out they were both partly wrong. His signal did go through from Western England to Eastern Canada. We know now, though, that the curve of the Earth does block the signal, but radio signals can go further because they bounce off the planet's ionosphere. Once in a while, we get reports of people picking up WPR in Europe. The first broadcast, S in Morse code. Hope we've gotten more interesting. Dot, dot, dot. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Biden administration says it will turn to indigenous communities around the country for info about the impacts of climate change and possible solutions. A researcher tells us it's long overdue. Now, insects are growing in popularity as an alternative food source. Many cultures around the world have integrated insect food sources into their diets, but we Western consumers have been a little bit hesitant. Advocates say many bugs are nutritious and delicious and have a lower impact on the environment than other sources of food. Insect agriculture is here in Wisconsin, and our next guest has been at the forefront of the industry in our state and around the country. Kevin Bockhuber is owner of Madison Cricket Farm and a managing member of Bockhuber Consulting. He founded the country's first edible cricket farm in Ohio before coming back to his home state of Wisconsin. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What got you started on the path of edible insects?
Yeah, so my first taste was back in 2006. I went to Thailand just for a vacation. And while we were there, we ate bugs and, you know, they tasted great. And when I came back to the U.S., I was like, we should all do this. And then it took a few years before I think anyone else was convinced.
Now, how does insect farming work? Paint us a picture of your cricket farm or ranch.
Yeah. So if you look at my cricket farm, it's 3,000 square feet of well-insulated warehouse space out into forest. There are long rows of just like those giant water tanks that have been cut in half. And inside those, there's a lot of like egg flats and some other stuff for the crickets to live on. Then they have some like feed and watering trays. And so these are mostly being sent to pet stores for to be fed live to lizards and other pets. So there's also a lot of boxing that we do there. Yeah, but it's largely inside, heat regulated, etc.
Now, I'm guessing a common response you get from humans as potential customers is along the lines of, ew, what do you say to people who are not really on board? I'd be into it, but people who aren't on board with eating crickets.
Yeah, so I've been doing this since 2014. I find that most people kind of have the same reaction as you do, where they're like, well, I would do it, but I don't know if anyone else will. I saw some market research that was done maybe a year or two ago, and it looked like, according to their survey data, about 19%, so one in five people in the U.S. has tried an insect in their lifetime. And those numbers were like 3 or 5% or less, you know, 10 years ago when we first got started here.
How are people eating the crickets that you sell? In what form? What kind of dishes?
Yeah, so my farm in DeForest isn't for human food at this point. We do have other farmers up in Minnesota and Iowa that do human food specifically. So I think the most popular way that people eat them and the way that they eat the most of them, which is, you know, of interest for me, is dry roasted and then seasoned with regional flavors. So you see like a lot of barbecue, a lot of kind of like Doritos flavors, or in Iowa, I know that dill pickle and vinegar is popular. Worldwide, you see a lot more like culinary applications for them. They're often kind of the more gourmet part of the meal.
And I read something about cricket flour.
Yeah. Yep. So that's crickets that have been dried and ground into a protein powder. You can replace somewhere between 5 and 10% of your normal flour in bread and other products like that with the cricket powder in it, or the cricket flour, and it'll work the same as baking anything else. And the powder tends to be 65 to 70% protein, so it adds quite a kick to an otherwise low protein or no protein food.
What is it that makes crickets or other insect foods particularly sustainable compared to other food sources?
Yeah, so I mean, there are some baseline facts that the insects use a lot less food and water and space to produce the same amount, the same number of pounds of food. I think that that's kind of just getting into the start of it, where we're really seeing some growth in the non-human food side of our industry. Is taking various types of insects and feeding them. We always talk about how like 35% of food gets wasted. So we're looking, so there's a lot of projects where they're feeding that kind of food waste into the insects, and then the insects are being made into things like animal feed and fertilizer. And that I think is really interesting from the sustainable development point of view. Because you're just being able to feed the same feed to like more animals and get more protein out of it. So it's significantly more efficient when it's integrated into traditional farming.
Now, whether we're growing crickets for human consumption or, as you said, for animal feed or pet stores or whatever, do you see this as a growth opportunity for Wisconsin in particular?
Yeah, I think I see the number of applications for insects, especially being incorporated into that the nutrient upcycling and the faster composting side. We produce just, you know, massive amounts of corn, wheat, and soy here, and there's a lot for example, there's a lot of that gets spoiled, and it can't be eaten by people or by like livestock because it'll get you sick. The insects don't have any problem eating the spoiled grains. And so sometimes a farmer might lose 30% of their crop to this, to these types of molds. So I think that that's where the significant opportunities in Wisconsin are.
And briefly, you grow crickets. Are there other insects that are human food potential opportunities here in our last half a minute or so?
Yeah, in the U.S., there's a couple, including mealworms, and then there's ones that have been traditionally imported up, including escamoles, which are a type of ant eggs. But over in, like, South Korea, they've really, like, recognized and supported 13 different species of insects that are recognized. More of that coming over to the U.S. in the coming years.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Kevin Bockhuber is owner of Madison Cricket Farm, managing member of Bockhuber Consulting. He was with us today to talk about the insect agriculture industry and insects that are safe for human consumption. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the family behind a mystical tourist attraction.
On the main drag of downtown Wisconsin Dells, there's a fantasy world called Wizard Quest. Here, visitors embark on an adventure to complete a number of quests. They answer questions about the environment, decipher riddles, and investigate hidden passageways. WPR's Trina LaSousa visited Wizard Quest to learn more about the family behind this unique tourist attraction that she's enjoyed since childhood.
When I was a kid, my family took a trip to the Wisconsin Dells. As we walked through the doors of Wizard Quest, we entered an alternate reality.
Your objective is to complete as many quests as you can within the timeline.
Here, we met fantastical creatures who sent us on quests. We discovered secret passageways and had adventures in places beyond our wildest imaginations. I returned almost two decades later to learn more about how Wizard Quest was created. Art director Karina Ricks guided me through one of the sets, which they refer to as realms.
And this is the aviary.
This is the aviary. We're in the air realm now. And yeah, this is inspired by creatures of flight. And we've added our own twist to birds. We've got some harpies up here.
Can you describe what a harpy is?
So a harpy from magical lore is a creature that is part woman, part bird. You know how you hear people say, quit harping on me. That comes from the harpies.
Karina Ricks and her family are the real wizards behind the attraction. They've created Wizard Quest's Quadrosphere, a live fantasy setting encompassing the fire, water, earth, and air realms. Questers embark on an adventure to find creatures to interact with using a portable tablet. Kevin Ricks is head of interactive design at Wizard Quest. He's also Karina's husband and game master.
When you first come into Wizard Quest, what we're trying to accomplish is to shut the outside world out and it completely immerse you into our world, a world of fantasy, a world of art, a world of dreams, and a world where anything is possible if you work together and if you believe in it.
Wizard Quest has been a family endeavor since it started in 2004. The majority of Kevin and Karina's adult children are involved in it too. The Ricks family works collaboratively to make the fantasy world a reality by creating new textures like forest tree bark and stone castle walls. Karina's oldest daughter, Cassie Ricks, has a favorite place called Coraline Reef.
You go in there, you're going to see all these cool barnacles and different coral structures, and really, if you get underneath all of the magic of looking at that, a lot of it's tinfoil.
Here, it's not just the sets that are magical. These realms are populated by dozens of custom creatures, like fairies, goblins, and mermaids. Braden Ricks is an artistic welder. He has a special fondness for Swindly, a 9-foot turtle with a starfish-shaped shell.
He was my personal favorite to make because he's my design, and then I was able to just weld the framework, and then my sister Cassie, after we foamed him, she did the carving and all of that.
Wizard Quest was created by the family nearly 20 years ago and has been perpetually adding new creatures and technology.
So one thing you can be sure of is that when you come back, something's going to be different. There'll be another layer that you didn't notice. There may be secret passages you didn't discover. And the game will always be evolving
for generations of families who enter Wizard Quest's fantasy realms.
WPR's Trina LaSousa brought us that story on Wizard Quest. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, find out how Indigenous communities here in the U.S. and around the world are helping to document the impact of climate change. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. At a recent White House summit for tribal nations, President Biden announced new guidance for the federal government to begin working with Indigenous communities to incorporate more of their knowledge into agency research and policymaking decisions, especially on environmental issues. Indigenous observations and understanding about things like climate have been seen as an untapped resource. Biden said acknowledging their value is part of a larger federal effort to be more respectful of tribal sovereignty and authority. What could this all look like in practice? Last week, I talked to Karim Ali Kassam, International Professor of Environmental and Indigenous Studies at Cornell University. What is your reaction to this announcement, this acknowledgement from the Biden administration looking to Indigenous people, Indigenous knowledge, as part of the effort to stop climate change?
So, first of all, my response is that this is long overdue. This needed to happen some time ago. But now that it has happened, there are a number of things we need to take into account. First and foremost, it is true, he is right, that these communities in their diverse parts of the United States have a history of living with the land and within the land, and as a result have deep knowledge that can give us insight into the effects of climate change and potentially how to collaborate with them in responding to it. The second thing is that Indigenous communities in North America or in Australia or anywhere else in the globe, in Asia, they didn't and do not contribute to climate change. And yet they are at the forefront of climate change. They are at the vanguard. So it's also a question of justice that we recognize this. And you saw that in the COP27 agreement where they recognize the damage and loss, and they recognize that there needs to be support for adaptation. The third thing that I think that's really important to keep in mind is that given this knowledge, given the substance and the depth of it, because it is cumulative over generations, if not millennia, this knowledge should not be co-opted. You know, when government bureaucracies take over, they can calcify, they can remove the vitality, the organicness of a dynamic knowledge system of these communities. And we have a history of colonization and cultural genocide. So I'm also worried that this recognition does not lead to bureaucratization and co-opting of Indigenous knowledge.
I wanted to ask you that, Karim. You've worked with communities around the world. How could, say, the Biden White House, make sure that this is an active partnership, getting concrete results as opposed to treating a community as a data set or just a symbolic outreach?
Right. So in this case, and because we claim that we are a democracy, participation is not a euphemism for taking their ideas. Participation here means scientists of different backgrounds, from climate science to ecology to social science, need to respectfully work with knowledge holders who are farmers, who are herders, who are hunters, who are fishermen, and so on, or fisher folk and orchardists. They need to work in tandem, collaboratively, and recognize that knowledge is co-generated. There is no one hero in knowledge generation. We depend on each other to build new ideas and new approaches. So that will be key: humility and mechanisms in the research process that ethically recognize and value the role of indigenous peoples as participants. And there's something else that's happening, and I can say that as a professor. Increasingly, the kids from these communities are studying at universities and are becoming scientists and leading science. So we should keep an eye out for these young people, both women and men, who also can contribute because they belong to these multiple ways of knowing, these multiple ways of thinking. And so they can be part of that process of developing solutions.
Are there examples you've seen from around the world of a successful collaboration like this between a government and an indigenous group on environmental issues, including climate change?
I think there are, if we look carefully enough, I think we will see that there are examples in the Canadian Arctic since the 1960s. We have some examples in Australia, as well as the United States and specifically in Alaska. When work began on climate change and when scientists began to explore climate change and what is happening to sea ice, they didn't have the words, nor did they have the depth of knowledge of sea ice morphology and phenology, how sea ice works, how currents and wind patterns affect sea ice. The depth and the nuanced aspect of that knowledge came from Inupiaq hunters, came from Inupiaq elders. And this informed the knowledge that climate scientists and physicists were developing in the Arctic. So there is evidence if we look. And this evidence is also borne out in our own research that we undertake in communities in the Arctic, as well as in the mountain regions of Central Asia.
Yeah, in our last minute or so, can you tell us a little bit about your latest research?
So we're looking at something called ecological calendars. We have evidence that human beings have used these calendars for thousands of years. And over thousands of years, there's obviously been climate change and environmental change. And communities have been able to anticipate change, have been able to anticipate the next season, whether they are hunting communities or farming communities or fishing communities. They've been able to anticipate this change by looking at indicators in their environment, such as arrival of a migratory bird, the level of snow cover, the sound of a particular frog, the appearance of an insect, the blossoming of a tree. And they've used a sequence of these indicators to plan livelihood activities. So we're saying, yes, the Gregorian or the Julian calendar based on the sun is important, but these communities, these human communities, have developed these calendars, and we can use these calendars to anticipate change in our communities, whether we live in Manhattan or we live in the mountains of Central Asia. The issue is that how do we anticipate? What mechanisms do we use? And here, I think, indigenous knowledge, coupled with respectful institutionalized science, can work together in building this capacity. And why is this capacity so important? Well, 70 to 80% of the world's food system still depends on the small landholder, on the small farmer, on the small herder. And so places like Beijing, like Nairobi, even places like Manhattan, depend on these food producers. So not only is it the right thing to do, it's a pragmatic thing to do to protect our food systems.
Kareem, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. I hope this was helpful.
That was Kareem Ali Kassam, International Professor of Environmental and Indigenous Studies at Cornell University. I talked to him last week about a recent announcement from the Biden administration that the federal government will collaborate with indigenous communities on research and policy decisions around things like climate change. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's a double feature on parenting. There's been a big jump in the number of men who stay at home to provide caregiving. They're still in the minority, but the trend is big. We'll look at what's driving it. If that is you, love to hear from you right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, motherhood was already challenging. The pandemic added a lot more problems and stress along the way. We'll look at challenges facing moms pre- and post-pandemic with the author of a new book called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a labor reporter joins us to talk about child care for working families and why American families are living in two very different worlds these days. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.